action.
Time now to chat again with Elaine Leung with details about a car fire in or near, the Caldecott Tunnel.
That's right. The eastbound direction heading for the Caldecott, that left bore is shut down. Traffic alert issued for this. CHP is directing traffic out of the left bore to the right. It was a pickup truck that caught fire. San Lorenzo, we still have three left lanes blocked. A crash northbound 880 before Hesperian, slow out of Hayward, and a crash coming in Palo Alto. Lookout southbound 101 at University. Elaine Leung for KQED.
Many thanks, Elaine. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car or truck is easy. We can arrange to have it picked up running or not in most cases and invest the funds back into our news coverage. You can learn more at kqed.org/cars. Here and now, up next at 11 on member-supported KQED-FM San Francisco, KQEI-FM North Highlands Sacramento, and online at kqed.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Deepa Fernandez.
And I'm Asma Khalid. It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the mayor of an Arizona town near the Mexican border reacts to a new White House plan to limit the number of people crossing the southern border unlawfully.
It's not a local issue. We need federal law enforcement presence over the entire border.
Also, nearly one in three Americans are employed and above the poverty line, but still struggle to make ends meet.
If my parents were able to somehow make it work, why can't I make it work on my own? Why are my parents always stepping in to help me?
Why life for so many does not square with the news of a strong economy.
And after strikes last year by Hollywood writers and actors, the studios are now negotiating with the union representing Hollywood crews. Coming up on Here and Now.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Biden is taking executive action aimed at curbing the high number of asylum seekers at the southern U.S. border. NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran has details.
The expectation is that Biden will invoke and rely on Section 212F of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which grants the president authority to block the entry of migrants he thinks are detrimental to the interests of the U.S. The provision would allow the president to suspend entries once the number of unauthorized crossings reaches a certain daily threshold. This section was used by President Trump in 2017 when he tried to ban immigration and travel from several majority Muslim countries. And just like during the Trump administration, Biden's proposal is likely to be challenged in court by immigrant rights groups. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News.
Jurors have heard opening statements in the federal trial against Hunter Biden on gun charges. The president's son returned to a Delaware courthouse this morning along with his wife, his sister, and First Lady Jill Biden. His trial began in Delaware just days after the hush money criminal trial of former President Donald Trump in New York ended in a conviction. In both cases, the defendants claim they are targets of election year politics. Wisconsin is the latest state to file charges over an alleged scheme to submit a slate of false electors in an attempt to overturn Trump's loss in the 2020 election. The state attorney general has charged lawyers Kenneth Chesbro and Jim Tropas, as well as former Trump campaign operative Mike Roman. Charges in the pro-Trump fake elector scheme have also been filed in Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, and Georgia. Major League Baseball has formally cleared Los Angeles Dodgers star Shohei Ohtani of any potential wrongdoing. But an hour earlier, the Japanese player's ex-interpreter, Ippei Mizuhara, pleaded guilty in a sports betting case. Syrian and Iranian media are reporting Israeli airstrikes in the Aleppo region of Syria killed several people yesterday, including an Iranian military advisor. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports there was no immediate comment from the Israeli military.
Syria's state-run Sana news agency and Iranian media reported the killing. The Tasnim news agency, seen as close to Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, identified the slain military advisor as Saeed Abyar. Iran has kept military advisors in Syria since the country's civil war broke out in 2011. Iran remains an important backer of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Last month, an attack on the Iranian diplomatic mission in the Syrian capital Damascus killed seven people, including two Iranian generals. This recent attack comes as Israeli forces battle Hamas and other Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip and also exchange fire with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 90 points at 38,661. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Paul Lancour. The Oakland City Council is set to vote today on naming an intersection after Bruce Lee. KQED's Sarah Hosseini reports the street is adjacent to the martial arts studio he founded there.
I have every movie that he's ever made, including all the ones that he made in Hong Kong before the United States even heard about him. I have almost every book that probably was ever published by him or about him.
Wow.
I have a tattoo.
Heading into the Toyota dealership on Broadway, office manager Lisa Marie Chu is pumped to let me in on what she considers one of the main perks of the post, the property's former tenant, Bruce Lee.
He was my first superhero.
The informal wall of film posters and photos behind her will soon be bolstered by something more official, a plaque in nearby street named Bruce Lee Way, in honor of the Bay Area-born global phenomenon and the Zhongfan Kung Fu Institute he founded here.
I think it's wonderful.
Jean Ching is the publisher of Kung Fu Magazine and former disciple of the famed Shaolin Temple. He says Lee was an innovator and an inspiration.
I think, you know, Bruce Lee has such an impact. And the Bay Area, he really was a son of the Bay Area, particularly Oakland and San Francisco. And, you know, it's time for us to take more credit.
The measure is related to a broader push by Oakland leaders to honor and attract film industry to the city. I'm Sarah Hosseini, KQED News.
In sports, the Giants have lost five straight. Last night, the Diamondbacks beat them 4-2. They're back at it in Phoenix this evening. The A's host the Mariners. I'm Paul Lancour, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, VentureX Capital One. What's in your wallet? Details at CapitalOne.com. And the listeners of KQED. Warm to hot inland today, and tomorrow the coolest spot, the coast today. A heat advisory in effect for inland areas today through Thursday. Temperatures will moderate towards the end of the week. In the meantime, Bay Area highs mid-60s to the upper 90s inland. Sacramento Valley highs today 97 to 103, up to 106 tomorrow.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California.
And I'm Asma Khalid in Boston. It's Here and Now. The White House announced new executive action that will limit the ability for people to claim asylum at the southern border. The president has been under pressure to make moves to tighten America's borders, an issue which Republicans and frankly even some Democrats have repeatedly attacked him on. In January, Biden received a letter from a group of mayors in Cochise County on Arizona's southern border with Mexico, criticizing him for the lack of action to date on dealing with border issues. One of the mayors who signed that letter was Clea McCaw, the mayor of the city of Sierra Vista, a mere 25 miles north of the border with Mexico. And he joins me now. Mayor McCaw, welcome to the show.
Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you.
So just a bit ago, the White House announced this new executive action that would essentially shut down asylum requests once border crossings reach a certain threshold. Do you think today's actions are enough?
Ma'am, great question. We don't see the issues reference asylum seekers coming across the border. We have other issues that are related to load cars coming north and fentanyl drugs coming north through our municipality. Do I think this executive action will be beneficial? Any progress is progress, in my view.
Hmm. So, Mayor, you live there in Arizona, as you say, about 25 miles from the border. Can you paint a picture of the scene that you see? I mean, what is the environment like for you all right now in Sierra Vista, particularly, I'd say, in years past? Because you say, I mean, you've lived in the area for a number of years.
To paint this environment, we are a safe community, yes. But we have some issues that are related to illegals coming north, endangering our residents and citizens. That issue has been documented in the letter to Congress and the President for them to fully staff our border with a federal law enforcement presence so that these activities can be curtailed.
How does this compare to what you've seen in the past? You've lived in the area for, what is it, over four decades?
Yes. I have lived here 40 years. How does it compare? The issues are always evolving. There's always going to be issues. During the last couple years that I've been in office, the one major issue that we have been seeing is the load cars and the fentanyl coming north.
Got it. You did not see as many cars coming through or as much fentanyl in years past?
No, ma'am.
Interesting. No, ma'am. When did you notice the uptick?
When I became mayor. 2023.
Okay. You mentioned this letter that you signed, a number of other local mayors signed on, asking the federal government, as you say, urgently for more support, for more staff to support the local law enforcement, for more advanced technology. You all wrote, and I'm quoting here, our communities and law enforcement agencies are being overwhelmed. Back in December, ma'am. I recall that your state's Democratic governor, Katie Hobbs, called for the National Guard to be sent to the border. Did that improve or affect the situation at all?
So when she approved the National Guard at the border, it was not in our area. So we had no National Guard presence in Cochise County. And really, it goes back to having this as a federal issue. We want the current administration and Congress to understand that it's a federal issue and we need a federal law enforcement presence.
So you want more troops, more border officials all across the southern border?
Thank you. We want Border Patrol all across the southern border to curtail this criminal activity coming north.
All right. Mayor, you're a Democrat, is that right?
I was a Democrat. I'm now an independent.
Oh, interesting. Why'd you switch?
Mm-hmm. During my campaign, when people asked me of my party, I said I was a Democrat. Most of the Republicans said, we don't like Democrats. So how can I serve effectively being a Democrat to a municipality that's Republican, that's independent, Democrats, Libertarian? My reasoning for switching parties to independent is I want to effectively govern everyone. I want to raise the issues of Sierra Vista to the federal government, and I think the way forward was to switch parties to independent.
All right, on that note, before I let you go, I want to ask you one big picture question. You mentioned that this is a nonpartisan issue. How would you grade the current administration's handling of immigration and border policy? In A being the best, right? Let's say in F being the worst.
How would I grade?
Yeah.
I would say this. Any progress is progress. Any progress from the current administration, any progress from Congress, we will fully support.
Can I ask, because it's hard for me to separate out the policy from the politics, and
yes,
we're
ma'am.
Inching very close to another presidential election cycle that is a rematch between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And they had somewhat different visions, you could argue, for immigration
yes,
policy. Did you think that the previous administration, the Trump administration, was more effective at handling border policy?
I cannot speak on the effectiveness of the Trump administration versus the effectiveness of the Biden administration. What I can speak about is what we do as a community, Sierra Vista, to raise issues to the federal government. If they act, if they react, great. But we will continue to raise these issues. And, you know, next time, I'm going to put my personal number on the letter so he will hopefully give me a call so I can tell them face-to-face, these are our issues.
Hmm. Clea McCaw is the mayor of the city of Sierra Vista near the southern border in Arizona. Mayor, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Long gone are the days when after the election, a group of workers sit around and count every ballot. For decades, machines have done the work. But in South Dakota today, voters from three counties will decide whether to revert back to hand-counting ballots during elections. The issue is part of a broader push from Republicans across the country to ban mail-in voting, early voting, and machine tabulators in favor of hand counts. Yet many experts say that hand counting is expensive and less accurate than existing systems, and it could cause delays that might further undermine trust in election results. Nevertheless, the movement has gained traction in parts of the country. One county in Georgia voted last year to manually hand count votes before election results are certified. For more on South Dakota, let's bring in Mackenzie Huber with the South Dakota Searchlight. Mackenzie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Mackenzie, as I said, today voters in three South Dakota counties will decide whether they want to switch from machine tabulators to hand counting.
Mackenzie, talk to me about the difference between a machine counting and humans, because in your reporting there is evidence presented that humans actually make more mistakes than machines. How so?
Humans tend to make mistakes. That's just sort of what research tells us. But with this as well, in South Dakota's setup and laws for hand counting, that's why you have people double checking how things are counted. So the results should still be accurate at the end of it. It might just take longer depending on how many mistakes you have and how many recounts you need.
You talked to one registrar who said, well, look at, you have election workers working like a 14-hour day. They start as people vote, and by the end of it, they're really tired. And that's when, you know, you're asking them then to count ballots with precision and accuracy. I imagine it gets a lot harder.
Yeah, and that's where these auditors, they would have to find new election workers to take over the hand counting, because they would not want those poll workers to have to work over 14-hour days.
So tell us why. Where is this push coming from for hand counting?
This has been in the works for at least 3 years now after the 2020 election. It's part of the national movement towards hand counting. And this is the first coordinated effort we've seen of this county-level petition movement. And it's coming from South Dakota Canvassing Group, which is a South Dakota organization focused and dedicated to election security and integrity, as they say.
Okay, and the group that's in South Dakota, the South Dakota Canvassing Group, do we know anything about its motivations?
Specifically, they want to give the elections back to the people, is the quote that I've heard when I've been talking to these group members. They don't like that a big piece of the election system that is put out to a third-party vendor and that doesn't take an oath to be transparent and do what's right, and they can't audit this through public records requests, since this is a third party private company. So
some people might say there is integrity in the way it's been done. There's never been a problem with tabulating. Who exactly is behind this? We know that there's a lot of Trump allies. There's the MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell, who's made this a national issue. Is there reason to doubt the way that South Dakota's machines have been counting ballots?
It depends on who you talk to. The members of this group say that there is, but when you talk to auditors, they say that the machines are accurate. They run tests before each election every year to ensure that they are accurate.
Tell me a little bit more about the auditors, because obviously they're the experts who have been looking at these machines closely. Do they have reasons to have doubts?
From what I've talked to about them, no, they do not.
And what do they tell you?
They tell me that the machines are accurate, that they're efficient, that they're cost effective, and that there's no reason to doubt them.
Okay. If voters say no to hand counting today, does that mean the issue is settled in South Dakota?
No, nope. These were just three petitions out of many. This is not something that's going to go away either at the county level, I think, or at the state level. This organization has been working for years to try to change election laws, and they're going to continue doing that with other pushes or by supporting potential legislators. I mean, we have several candidates who are also going to be on the ballot today who will support this group's efforts. So,
Mackenzie Huber is with the South Dakota Searchlight. Thank you so much, Mackenzie.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
We'll be right back.
It might be easy to forget about COVID this summer, but new waves have emerged each year among all those vacation plans and air-conditioned gatherings.
The virus continues to evolve to try to escape the wall of immunity we have built up through vaccines and infections.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. What to expect from COVID this summer? That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
COVID is still out there, isn't it? Hear more about it. Get the latest at 1 today on KQED, then at 2.
Protests have signaled public criticism of U.S. policy in Gaza, but inside the corridors of power, there are also signs of dissent. When Army Major Harrison Mann told colleagues last month that he was resigning, he said it was to protest the U.S. role in civilian deaths in Gaza. Mann speaks openly about his critique and why he resigned from active duty. Next time on The World.
And that's just one of the global stories, the latest world stories as they develop at 2 today. Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. And Xfinity, customers can get wall-to-wall Wi-Fi that extends coverage throughout the home. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and your NPR station, and the Music Emporium, guitar sellers for more than 50 years, celebrating the enduring presence of music made on the front porch and center stage. You can learn more at themusicemporium.com.
It's Here and Now. As the U.S. economy continues to grow, a rising number of Americans say they are still struggling to pay for basic needs. Jessica Fernandez is one of them. She's a single working mom from Hillsborough, New Jersey.
I haven't taken a vacation in 6 years, and I was hoping to take one this year, but it's not going to happen because I ended up having unexpected expenses, so we're just going to have to wait another year.
Jessica brings in about $45,000 a year from a few different jobs. She's a budding real estate agent, a part-time accountant for a small business, and is now considering a side hustle with Instacart. But she says juggling the cost of food, rent, utilities, a car payment, insurance, and childcare is almost impossible to manage without help from her parents. 29% of Americans are in a boat just like Jessica, where they are above the poverty line, but still can't quite make ends meet. That's the finding of a new report out from the U.S. research organization United for Alice. Stephanie Hoops is an economist and expert in financial hardship. She joins us now to share more about the findings. Stephanie, welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Stephanie, tell us about this term, Alice, that describes people like Jessica Fernandez. Who else might fall into this category?
Alice is an acronym for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed, and Alice lives in every community across the country, every state, every county. It's really important to recognize there's no one Alice type, and we don't want to feed any stereotypes that there's a structural problem in our economy, and it's not that folks aren't trying hard. So folks have probably run into several Alice workers by the time they got to their office today at the coffee shop, childcare, their bank, the security guard at the parking lot. They're people that are very familiar to us, the essential workers in our economy.
And is it just that what they're paid is, you know, minimum wage?
So what we track at United for Alice is not only wages, but also the cost of living. And we see a huge variation across this country. And so, for example, for a family of four, two adults, an infant, and a child care, it can range from $68,000 in El Paso, Texas, to $91,000 in Columbus, Ohio, to $133,000 in Arlington, Virginia. And you compare that to the federal poverty level, which is only $27,000 everywhere in the country, that our official statistics really are not telling us what's happening.
So in other words, what I'm hearing is, you know, where you live matters. And that's because the cost of living is different in different places, despite the fact that you might have one or two full-time incomes coming in.
Exactly.
Yeah. Jessica also told us something that she really struggles with is her mindset about being in this financial situation.
If my parents were able to somehow make it work, why can't I make it work on my own? Why do I always, you know, why are my parents always stepping in to help me? And for so many years, I was very afraid to talk about all of this because I didn't want to be judged. But now I'm not. Now I just want to talk about it because I feel like talking about it will lead to change.
You know, there are so many people in that situation who maybe went through college, even got better educated than their parents, yet their parents still have to help them. There's clearly a stigma talking about money so openly like this. I wonder, were you surprised because your findings were that 29% of Americans are still struggling, just like Jessica?
Exactly. And we've seen that number increase over the last decade through a pandemic and economic recovery. So it is very concerning that we're seeing so many folks and that the number continues to increase.
We also asked Jessica how it feels from her perspective to see headlines about a strong economy.
It's frustrating, to be honest, because I'm living it and I'm not seeing a change. I'm actually seeing things get worse.
So this is an example of how there seems to be, you know, a real disconnect between how some people view the economy. You know, it's doing well, but the Pew Research Center finds fewer than a quarter of Americans currently rate our economic conditions as excellent or good. How do you square those two?
What we're seeing is a big increase in the cost of living. At the same time, a lot of conflicting forces happening, inflation, public assistance going away. And so as people may feel that they're doing better in terms of wages, those wages are not keeping up with inflation. And we hear what Jessica's saying a lot. Folks are working really hard and they feel like they're getting ahead. And then they look around and they see that they're not. So it's almost like, you know, walking up a mountain of sand and you take two steps up and then you slide back down. Whereas the economic statistics that we're hearing at the macro level are looking at the overall economy and not people's individual experience.
I mean, is it as simple as the federal poverty level needs to be raised so that more people would qualify for some kind of help?
That would be a certainly would be a start. Currently, 13% of households are below that federal poverty level, and we're seeing another 29% are ALICE. So to your point, 42% of folks are struggling. Providing more assistance to those ALICE households would make a big difference. We're also seeing lots of ways that folks can address this challenge, from state agencies, taking the long view, planning transportation and social services, smoothing benefits cliffs, but also companies can play a big part. There are things that they can do in terms of wages and benefits that make a huge difference for ALICE, but also scheduling, career development, resources, and we're seeing some sparks of hope there, and we know that a lot more needs to happen.
Stephanie Hoops is the National Director of United for ALICE. Stephanie, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Really interesting conversation.
Now, girls in the United States are getting their periods earlier and less regularly. That's the finding of a new study based on data from an Apple app. Starting your menstrual cycle earlier can lead to a host of issues that go beyond reproductive health. Let's bring in Annalisa Morelli. She's been covering this for our partners at STAT. Annalisa, this study was based on data from the Apple Research app. More than 71,000 women participated. What were the major findings?
So there were two. One is that the age of menarche, which is when you get your first period, has gone down. So in 1950, girls would get their periods on average at 12.5 years, and now it's less than 12 years. It's 11.9. So there's a 6 months earlier, you know, in the onset of menstruation. And then the second finding, which is equally important, is that it takes longer for periods to become regular. So usually, you know, a girl will have a first period and then for, you know, a year or two, it will be irregular and then it sort of starts standardizing. But that time is taking longer.
So this data here, it was an app from Apple. Was it self-reported and how reliable was it?
It was. And, you know, the people who conducted the study note that obviously there is some bias, particularly some memory bias. People will have to remember when they had their first period. But there's been a bunch of other studies before that have shown quite a good correlation between what people remember about those events and what actually happened in those events. And so they feel pretty strongly that this data can be trusted.
And what are some of the possible longer-term health issues associated with getting your period earlier and having an irregular cycle? And we should notice that while the average period age went down to 11, as you were just saying, some girls are getting it as early as 9 years old. What's the implication of that for longer-term health?
Yeah, the number of women or girls who get it very early has also gone up. And there's long-term issue, cardiovascular issues, breast cancer can increase, early death. These are all usually linked to the length of exposure to estrogen. So essentially women are exposed to higher levels of estrogen longer, and that can have health impact.
And scientists aren't sure why menstruation is changing so much, but some think obesity and stress could be a factor. Tell me more.
They found some correlation with an increase in body mass. And also, there's been other studies that have shown that increased stress sort of affects the age of first period. And it's important to note, too, that the groups of people who seem to be most affected by this trend are either, you know, in sort of like a lower socioeconomic circumstances, so they have more adversities and stress in life, or they belong to ethnic and racial minorities, which again is associated with, you know, racial stress and discrimination and other things that sort of increase chances both of stress and also make it harder to get good food and a good diet and all of the things that sort of, you know, can reduce the chances of obesity.
And is there something to be done here? Can or maybe should doctors make interventions when someone gets their period early or has an irregular cycle to protect them against some of these longer-term health issues?
I would say two things. So one is just little, it seems that you can do once that has happened, but it's good for women to have a sense that that is happening. But really what this study points to is systemic issues that need to be addressed. And, you know, if indeed there is a strong correlation with stress and obesity, like those are bigger issues that can be addressed in an individual health. And of course, more studies, you know, the reason why we don't really have a good intervention at the time of menarche is also because there's not a lot of research that's been done in it. Mm. And so, you know, more funding and more studies in women's health would greatly help the situation.
Annalisa Morelli is a general assignment reporter with our partners at STAT. Thank you so much, Annalisa.
Thank you for having me.
This is Here and Now.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Steve Brown. Attorney General Merrick Garland is pushing back against what he calls unprecedented attacks on the Justice Department. In testimony before the House Judiciary Committee today, Garland condemned, quote, baseless and extremely dangerous falsehoods being peddled about the FBI and slammed threats to defund the special counsel prosecutions of former President Donald Trump. Garland's appearance today comes as Republicans have moved to hold him in contempt for the Biden administration's refusal to hand over audio of President Biden's interview with special counsel Robert Hur. Security in Beijing is tight around Tiananmen Square as China marks 35 years since a bloody crackdown on pro-democracy protests. Police checkpoints and rows of police vehicles could be seen along major roads today. China has long quashed any memory of the deadly suppression when the Chinese government ordered in the army to end the months-long protest and uphold communist rule. U.S. job openings fell in April to the lowest level since 2021, but they remained at historically strong levels despite high interest rates and signs the economy is slowing. The Labor Department reports that employers posted 8.1 million vacancies in April, down from a revised 8.4 million in March. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for KQED comes from PG&D, reminding customers to act quickly if they smell gas in their homes or business. Get outside, travel a safe distance away, and dial 911. First responders will make it safe. Learn more at pge.com/safety. KQED Live presents a night of contemporary jazz music and a look at the local scene live on stage with the podcast Right Nowish. June 20th, 7 p.m. You can get tickets at kqed.org/live, supported by the San Francisco Symphony. Stay comfortable and cool and hydrated today around the Bay. Heat advisory now in effect until Thursday, according to the National Weather Service. Warm to hot this afternoon, mid-60s to the upper 90s around the Bay Area. 78 maybe, San Francisco today, 86 in Oakland. 97, possibly Concord, Livermore the same. Hotter in Sacramento, a high of 101 is forecast with the overnight low, 71. Hotter tomorrow.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And Boston University's Questrom School of Business, presenting the Is Business Broken podcast. Conversations about the role of business, stakeholder relations, and government at bu.edu/Questrom or wherever podcasts are available.
It's Here and Now. Movies can be powerful cultural messengers for ideas, behaviors, and values. But a team of researchers says the movies of the last decade or so have missed an opportunity because very few of them address the urgency of climate change. The researchers surveyed 250 of the most popular movies between 2013 and 2022, and NPR's Catherine Fink reports on what they found.
Over the last 10 years or so, the reality of our warming climate has cropped up in some unexpected places, like Pokemon Detective Pikachu from 2019.
At this point, how can you not believe in climate change?
Or Kingsman Secret Service from 2014.
Climate change is a threat which affects us all, Mr. Valentine.
Or 2022's Glass Onion.
I'm a hard line on climate change. If that scares you, go stick your head back in the sand.
Each of these movies passed the climate reality check. That's a new metric modeled after the Bechdel test, which measures the representation of women in film. The climate reality check evaluates whether a movie acknowledges the reality of climate change. And there are basically just two requirements. One, climate change has to exist. And two, a character has to know about it.
It is an incredibly low bar. And then you actually look at the number of films, the percentage of films that are passing it, and it's still shockingly low.
Matthew Schneider Meyerson of Colby College in Maine is one of the developers of the Climate Reality Check, alongside the storytelling consultancy Good Energy. He spent his whole summer watching movies, and his team found that fewer than 10% of those movies cleared the bar. But the ones that did mention climate change actually fared better commercially than those that did not. Schneider Meyerson and his collaborators say, based on their findings, Hollywood shouldn't be afraid of climate narratives, even if they're dark or depressing, because they're clearly resonating with viewers.
Most audiences would like to see their reality reflected on screen. You know, I think for most of us, increasingly climate change is a part of that reality.
Schneider Meyerson says the inclusion of climate change in popular films more than doubled between 2013 and 2022. And the types of movies also expanded. Superhero films were a mainstay at first. And then,
in the second half of the decade, we did see, you know, climate change appearing in people's daily lives in sort of more quotidian ways. And I think that's a really important development.
Take the romantic drama Marriage Story from 2019. Adam Driver's character is constantly flicking off the lights.
He's energy conscious.
Schneider Meyerson says the most impactful way to address climate change on screen is by modeling individual and collective action. He hopes that's where more movies are headed next.
You know, if we see characters that are living slightly different lives, it's likely to normalize it for folks and hopefully to lead to more acceptance and practicing of these climate positive behaviors.
So that's the power of storytelling on screen. But meanwhile, there's the climate footprint of the industry itself, which is massive for every film that's made. So when it comes to the reality of climate change in film, there's a good reason to ask what movies to make, but also how we should make them. Catherine Fink, NPR News.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, how climate change is one of the key adversaries the Coast Guard is battling during its strategic war games this week. You can hear that story wherever you are, on your radio or your phone. It's Here and Now.
The big man from Brooklyn, Fat Joe, is not just a rapper, he's also a healthcare activist.
So this is something that's very bipartisan, and it's something that affects all of the American people.
In our series, We the Voters, Fat Joe tells us why he started campaigning for cost transparency in healthcare. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Catch the conversation tomorrow morning along with the latest news and your California report starting at 2 until 9 a.m. This week on the Right Nowish podcast, Miguel Bounce Perez's culture flows through his ink. Right Nowish talks with the artist about how childhood memories influences murals and tattoos. Catch the conversation wherever you get your podcasts. Support for KQED comes from Visit Modesto, offering a summer filled with nostalgia and fruit. Visitors can explore farm stands, pick fruit, and experience graffiti summer starting June 5th. More at visitmodesto.com. Hassler Heating and AC, advancing California's electric initiatives by converting homes to heat pump technology. For installation or repair of heating and cooling equipment, visit hasslerheating.com. Thank you for listening to KQED. I'm Dave Freeman. The announcers and technical staff are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51, AFL-CIO.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Loomis Sayles, working to fulfill the investment needs of institutional and retail clients worldwide by integrating proprietary research and risk analysis to develop a customized approach for each investor. LoomisSales.com and WBUR, presenting Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder, a family torn apart, and the woman who wasn't believed. Listen now to Beyond All Repair from WBUR and ZSP Media.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California.
And I'm Asma Khalid in Boston. It's Here and Now. Made in Egypt. Increasingly, those three words appear on our clothing tags. But behind those words are the dramatic and sometimes tragic stories of young Egyptian women in garment factories. A new book on the topic shows how Egypt is modernizing differently from many other countries. Women still face heavy traditional cultural expectations to get married, have children, and not work. The book is Egyptian Made, Women, Work, and the Promise of Liberation. My colleague Scott Tong spoke with author Leslie T. Chang.
Leslie, you spent many years as a reporter in China years ago, wrote a great book called Factory Girls, and you describe kind of this, you know, I was based in China too, uber-capitalist model, and where for many young women, it was such the opportunity to jump into modernity. And then years later, you and your family, you find yourself in Egypt, where the description of factory life almost seems this upside-down world in many ways. What surprised you? What had you say, this is not what I expected?
Yeah, so I had, as you said, spent many years reporting in Chinese factories, and I finally found some factories in Egypt, and it was amazing because the women were really different from the ones I'd seen in China. They were much more outgoing. They were talking on their phones. They would throw their clothes that they were working on across the assembly line to each other to work on. There was a lot of looseness. And from China, you have this very clear kind of capitalist equation. You go there, you make money, you climb up the ladder, you reinvent yourself. Yeah. But in Egypt, it was much more complicated. And certainly people were working. The women who I met in the factories were working for money. But a lot of them were working because there were so few opportunities for them to get outside the home. Another huge difference with China is that the economic growth, as you know, is much less. Yeah. So you see this weird thing where women might be working quite hard and making some money, but it wasn't enough to get all the men in their lives to say, oh, wow, this woman's making a lot of money. Let's listen to what she has to say, or let's respect her. Mm. Instead, everyone could say, oh, she's just working for fun. You know, we don't need her money. It's just extra.
One woman, Rania, works in a you know, men's underwear factory, becomes a supervisor. And tell us why you focused on her.
Well, you know, often as I found reporting, and I'm sure you found this as well, it's often not that you find the subject, but the subject finds you. Mm. So what happened was I was walking around this factory in Upper Egypt, and then this woman kind of came up to us while I was talking to somebody else and said, "Excuse me, are you working here? Because I'd like to be friends with you." You know, and I was like, huh,
who are you?
Is this person? Yes, and just really outspoken, really strong-willed, but she also had a pretty tough background. She came from not just an ordinary family, but also had a lot of marital issues with her husband. So I followed her story over a couple years.
And you looked at factory life for parts of your book through Rania's eyes. And so many details, but one fascinating one to me was when there was a factory worker who fainted, but actually fainted. And this is a factory where I believe Rania was a manager. What happened then? What's it tell us?
It was actually during Ramadan, which, as you know, is a time when most Egyptians who are devout won't eat or even drink from sunup to sundown. And it was 107 degrees on the factory floor. This is kind of in the middle of June. There was a big commotion on one part of the factory floor, and a woman was sort of collapsed in her chair, and people were fanning her. And it went very quickly from disturbing and dramatic to, oh, this is kind of an interesting performance and kind of a drama, you know, because it was clear that she was okay and everyone was very excited.
Like she just recovered immediately and suddenly
was. Yeah. And Rania told me afterwards, oh, she was one of my workers, but she was switched to another line, and she's trying to get back onto my production line. So
did she get what she wanted?
Yeah, no. So she got switched to the line she wanted, but then that angered somebody else. So eventually, she got switched back again. Oh. You know, within the family and within the village, these young women are quite powerless, and it was interesting how they took these tools from the family and the village, which is, you know, anger and sort of these performative moments in which they show their anger and try to get other people on their side, and how they use that within the factory setting.
Mm. As you say, Rania has a lot of challenges that you experience or you learn as you get to know her, and her husband takes on a second wife. What is Rania's version of that story and the challenges, I don't know, the shame that it brings?
Yeah, so, you know, like most women in her village, she got married at a very young age. She was 16, and it was somebody who her father had chosen for her, and their marriage sort of broke down within a couple years. So by the time I met Rania, she had been living separate from her husband. Mm. And so she was sort of working in the factory, and during one of these stays when she was away, she learned that her husband had taken a second wife. Mm. She eventually went back and moved back into her house because she had two young children. She was worried about their welfare. Mm. You know, much later in the story, I finally was able to talk to Yasser, her husband. And I said, you know, what's going on, Yasser? Like, what were you thinking and what were you doing? And he just said, oh, we had this fight and I was just mad at her, and I just wanted to show her she has every right to be angry. I'm sorry that she's so upset. Ugh. In this situation, you see him as the villain, but when you look at the whole system in which a lot of these people are quite powerless, these small angry moments and mistakes kind of get blown up and become these, you know, really difficult situations that people can't undo.
Another episode that comes up several times in your book is the Arab Spring. You know, viewing these uprisings, it's been more than a decade now, right, in many Gulf states against authoritarian governments, were things a lot of people in the U.S. would find encouraging. What I found interesting is another woman you spent a lot of time with is Riham. Mm-hmm. She has some of her goods, her products in her factory stolen. How did she kind of comment in the Arab Spring in a way that to her was not helpful to society?
Yeah, it was really interesting. So we arrived in Egypt at the end of 2011. And of course, we'd seen all the inspiring images on TV, but by the time we arrived, sort of the bloom was off the rose, and it was clear that these wonderful ideals were not going to be put into practice. Democracy was not going to be happening, and the people in charge were going to be the same military people who are always in charge. And so when I spoke with Raham about this, it was interesting because she's definitely a liberal, somebody who was very supportive of overturning Mubarak and of having democracy and of having people have voices. But what she said was, you know, after that first moment of promise and excitement, it just ended up being even worse. From the outside, we still have this image in our minds of the people protesting, many of whom were women. And we just think, well, if you, you know, bring down a dictator in 26 days, like there has to be something good that comes of it. But in fact, you know, these were young people who were mostly connecting through social media. And they did not really have a program. They didn't really have an organization. They didn't really have any experience in compromise and setting up organizations and sitting down and writing bylaws, you know, all these things that are necessary to forming a government after you've toppled one. And so, you know, nothing came of this glorious moment.
Finally, Leslie, toward the very end, you describe this Egypt that after several years living there, confounds, right? There are opportunities and challenges. Yet in the end, you yourself describe yourself having some hope for Egypt. Yeah, how so?
I went away from the country really mixed. The things that Egypt needs to do, it needs to reform its education system, it needs to have a coherent economic policy, and it needs to give more equality towards women. And I do not see the current military leadership doing any of those things. But I also feel like a lot can change, you know, and the lesson is China, because, you know, China, for the communists, when they came to power in 1949, for all their later misdeeds, one of the first things they did was to overturn a lot of the patriarchal traditions about, you know, arranged marriage and to encourage women to work in large numbers. And we still see the effect today.
Yeah.
And the greater kind of feeling I had was just Egyptians themselves tend to be just sunny, great sense of humor, always hospitable, helping strangers, helping people in need. And it's that spirit that I feel like if they get the right leader, things can turn around.
The book is Egyptian Made, Women, Work, and the Promise of Liberation. And the author is Leslie T. Chang. Leslie, congratulations on getting the book out, and thanks so much for the time.
Thanks, Scott.
It's Here and Now.
Ahead on Here and Now during the noon hour on KQED, what happened when a museum in tiny Brownsburg, Virginia, worked with descendants to uncover the slavery in the town's history? More ahead next hour. Support for KQED comes from Style Bath & Kitchen, a locally owned business bringing tailored kitchens and bathrooms to life for over 25 years with brands such as Toto and California Faucets. Listeners can learn more by searching Style Bath & Kitchen online. Afternoon news quiz coming up today on KQED through the rest of the week as well, 5:48 p.m. the time. When you hear today's quiz question, go to kqed.org/radionewsquiz. Enter your answer. You'll get a chance to win a two-night stay at the beautiful Canyon Ranch Woodside.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from your NPR station, from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. And Rhodes Scholar, a not-for-profit educational travel organization offering adventures for adults in more than 100 countries. Learn more at roadscholar.org/explore.
It's Here and Now. The summer blockbuster movie season is off to one of its slowest starts in two decades as major Hollywood studios try to reach a contract agreement with the people who play a crucial role in bringing these stories to the big screen, the crew. This comes after actors and writers ratified contracts last year following high-profile labor strikes. Members of the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, or IOTSE, are taking on issues like wages, working conditions, and the use of artificial intelligence. Let's check in on the latest with Katie Kilkenny, who covers labor and media for The Hollywood Reporter. Katie, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Set the scene for us, Katie. We heard a lot about the actors and writers strikes last year. Hollywood was mostly shut down for months over this until an agreement was reached. How much has the TV and film production business picked up since then?
Yeah, I mean, the big takeaway is that it really hasn't picked up much. The industry did not come roaring back after the strikes. Mm. So for the workers, not just the writers and actors, but also crew members and others, and for the business at large, it's still a really hard time. According to the LA Film Office, production days in the first quarter of this year were down 9%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it was down 9% compared to 2023, which itself was down 24% from the year prior. And what we keep hearing at The Hollywood Reporter is stories of folks who have been out of work for a really long time, writers, reality workers, crew members, or are just not able to get the level of employment that they were hoping for or expecting after being out of work for so long last year.
And, you know, that's hard to hear because, as we said, actors and writers did reach a contract agreement. Now we're talking about crew members. Who are they? What jobs do they do?
Yeah, so it's kind of what you would expect when you think of a crew member. So folks like editors, cinematographers, costume designers, drivers, who belong to two different unions, including IATSE and the Teamsters. Many, many folks, I mean, IATSE, just one of their contracts is tens of thousands of workers on the West Coast. So that gives you a sense of just how many people we're talking about.
You know, and to some degree, you know, I want to think maybe actors and writers are a little more higher profile. Maybe they had more chance of quickly having their demands met in contract negotiations. But crew members, more behind the scenes, we don't really know who they are by name or anything like that. Is that playing into it? Is it a harder negotiation for them because of the jobs they hold?
You know, I would say it's a different negotiation because on the one hand, yes, as you say, there's fewer folks who are high profile. Maybe some film nerds might know the names of certain cinematographers, but most people don't. For most people, they are one of the many names that scroll on the list of credits at the end of a movie. But they also are completely essential for production to happen at all. So if they did go on strike, for instance, they would completely shut down the industry. Writers didn't necessarily have that power, per se.
Interesting. So tell us what IATSE wants. What's at the core of these negotiations?
Yeah, a lot of it are just kind of things that are bottom line issues. So trying to improve and replenish health and pension funds after the strikes of last year with so many folks out of work. Those funds really took a hit. Trying to improve wages after a period of inflation that I think we've all felt. A big evergreen issue for crew members is working conditions. These people work 12, 14, 16-hour days, and so they want to make sure they're getting rest periods and feel safe when they're driving home after work. And then also AI, of course, just given that that is such a rapidly developing issue.
And we've heard that talks are stalled. What are the issues that it's stalled over?
So they are keeping things close to the vest, but something I've heard from sources is that, at least when it comes to the West Coast negotiations, AI and benefits still aren't worked out yet. So what we've been hearing is things are progressing, but they still need additional negotiation dates to work things out.
And spell out for us what the demand is around AI, because with writers, it's pretty obvious to figure out how AI could be helpful there. But say with costume design or set design, how does AI work in there?
To be honest, it really depends on the craft, and IATSE sort of represents so many different crafts that we don't know all the specific issues at this time. Editors are going to have very different demands than cinematographers will, for instance. So it's going to be incredibly interesting to find out what they've figured out on AI when they do finally get a deal, because they just represent so many different people.
And tell us a timeline, Katie. You know, is there any possibility that they may strike if they don't get what they want?
There is certainly a possibility. The contracts, many of them, expire on July 31st, so we still have some time, after which point the union could go on strike, IATSE could go on strike. The union has said that essentially, if there is no deal in place by July 31st, they will consider doing a strike authorization vote where members will say whether they want to strike or not. So the jury's really still out, and we have some time to go before we see how things are going to progress.
Katie Kilkenny, labor and media reporter for The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California.
And I'm Asma Khalid in Boston. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Landmark College in Vermont, offering summer programs for high school and college students to help discover their learning abilities and help achieve academic and social success, in-person and online options. More at landmark.edu/summer.
I'm Vanessa Rancagno. I cover housing for KQED. As we've seen homelessness rise in California, we've seen cities increasingly turn to tiny homes as one way to, at least theoretically, get people off of the streets quickly. And so what I really wanted to know is just, is this a good idea? Is this a smart investment? You can find my story Tuesday at KQED.